This is Application Paranoia episode 15. Yeah. So welcome again to Application Paranoia, our podcast about application security, DevSecOps, and AppScan. Twice a month, we aim to bring you technical insights and assorted facts about all things from the world of application security. I'm Colin Bell, and with me on the panel, I have my tried and true colleagues, Rob Cuddy and Chris Dewar. This week, we'll be talking to Darius Bennett. He's a CEO of Darius Enric Bennett, a professional corporation, about the intersection of data privacy and security. So this episode will be all about privacy. So welcome, Rob. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well, Colin. We are having some fun here, so it's all good.
Nice, yeah.
Nice fall morning.
Fall. Yeah. Yes. Do you have fall in California?
We
you
do.
Just had, I just thought you had...
Autumn?
No, you get autumn is over this side of the world.
Yeah, exactly.
And Chris, how are you doing?
Yeah, we're doing pretty good here. Just coming out of our latest heat wave of 70 degrees, which was nice. But we're going into a little bit colder weather, rainy weather on the weekend. So we'll see what we can do to get out there and do stuff.
You had a heat wave? Wow.
Yeah, if we call it a heat wave, because it's not typical this time of year to have 70 degrees short t-shirt weather. But
last time we were talking to you, you were shoveling snow. So what the hell's going on?
it's New England exactly. For you. Imagine it's a lot of the U.S. that has this problem, but we like to call it four seasons in a day.
Yes. Well, out where I am, Chris, if it dips below 70, we call that a cold front.
It's no longer t-shirt weather for y'all. It's jackets and right. What do they call it? I call them toques, but apparently that's not what they're called.
Here in Ireland, we have two seasons. We have warm rain and cold rain. We're officially in the cold rain season.
Don't get caught out in the cold rain. Warm rain, not so bad.
So you guys have been voting.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. So, yes. I mean, how do you manage to make an election last for months? You know, it's like...
Yeah, so we're well,
it takes a certain amount of skill. This isn't the first time this has happened, though. It does happen from time to time. It's a little nerve-wracking for every American, though. We'd just as soon have it over and done with, but you know, you got to do what you got to do, I guess.
Yes, and the world is getting an education on what the Electoral College actually is and does, and so that's produced a huge amount of debate, so very fun.
Twitter's very busy as well.
Oh, yes.
This election, yes. So.
Very much so. Yes, but it kind of actually leads right in because I figured that since it was election week, you know, and in the U.S.
Election month.
Election year.
Exactly. Right. Why should anything be normal this year? Right. And so we always do our elections on the first Tuesday or so in November. It's usually like November 3rd, 4th, something like that. Right. And the reason is obvious, right? It's because back when the country was founded, people had to go to vote, and sometimes they traveled large distances, and Sunday was considered a holy day, so everybody was traveling Monday to go vote, and that made Tuesday the ideal day for farmers and stuff like that. But did you know that at one point in the early 1800s, 1880s or so, that brain size was actually considered to be an important part of the candidacy. And there were places in 1884 in particular where candidates were actually comparing skull size, and enough so that diagrams of their heads along with the dimensions and stuff like that were being published in the newspaper. So
can you imagine that being the feature that separates you in a race? Well, he has a big bean, so I guess he's pretty smart.
They call it phrenology, and I'm just like, wow. He's got a very nice chin, but
but his head is tiny, so no good. I'm not voting for no little head what is it, politician. You can imagine the, what is it, big head, big change.
Exactly.
some of the yard signs they had back then written on straw or whatever.
written in straw?
I don't know. You said farmers. I have no idea how it was done back then. I wasn't alive in 1700s.
Hey, do you guys happen to know who the first woman to run for president was?
This obviously wasn't Hillary.
Yeah, I'm guessing this is a trick question.
No.
This actually shocked me. It was a woman named Victoria Woodhull back in 1872.
I guess she didn't win,
no? No, she did not win, but the fact that she ran was very cool back at that point. And in that same election, though, not only did we have Victoria Woodhull, but President Grant actually ran against a dead opponent, a guy named Horace Greeley, and he happened to die during the election process. Yeah. So... yeah, so if you think our year was crazy.
And did his vote count? Just saying.
Yeah, I'm not sure. They may have to deal with some hanging chads on that one, too. So.
Yeah. You even imagine, I have a bigger head than him, but I'm dead.
Yes. Little fun fact for you, Chris. Back in 1801, because this is a New Hampshire claim to fame, right? So with the Electoral College, James Monroe was running at that point, and he actually received every single electoral vote but one. And the one he did not receive was from a New Hampshire delegate who wanted George Washington to be the only president that was ever elected unanimously.
That sounds like us. Because reasons is the reason for a lot of things we do.
Exactly. So there you go. There are some really fun little electoral tidbits.
I mean, we could learn a lot from that, though. First Tuesday in November. I mean, we could learn a lot by not having meetings on Monday. No meetings Monday. Who's with me? That's my new platform. That's some big head thinking for you.
Big head, big change, no Monday.
No Monday.
I mean, this is going to go out in between now and your Thanksgiving, but that doesn't fall on a normal day of the week either. That's on a Thursday. So what's the thinking behind that? Is that because families traveling further and they start traveling on the Monday and it takes them till Thursday to arrive home, is it?
It's a really good question. I don't honestly know.
We're going to have to figure that out. That is curious.
Check that out on our next podcast.
Back in the day, we're going to visit our neighbor. He'll be back in 4 weeks.
Yeah. Yeah. Something tells me it's got more to do with wanting a four-day weekend.
No, I always found it unusual because a lot of people have national holidays and it falls on a certain date. Like Ireland is always the 17th of March is St. Patrick's Day. So it's just curious that it's on a Thursday. It's not the same day every year, you know, they say.
Well, and it's always the fourth Thursday in November.
So AppScan News, we have a few things in AppScan News since we last spoke, Chris.
Yeah, we added new language support for Vue.js, which is very similar to React Native and all those other things for your mobile apps to be able to, you know, have a nice UI, pretty UI, and you don't have to write all the backend code nonsense that you usually have to. So that's nice. And we did parallel processing for Java applications, which is something we have been working on for a while. The beauty of this bad Larry is you get to have incremental scans in a fashion, because if we already know the answer to some of this work that we've done, we just use that answer and continue on to the next class that we haven't analyzed yet. So we really get to use a lot of the parallel processing techniques that you would see in massively scalable apps, but we do it all, you know, for one app. It's really cool. The idea behind it uses our same engine, our same technologies and all of that stuff. We're just using it in a slightly different fashion to be able to scan a class file in a vacuum as opposed to an app entirely in the same memory space. So we can kind of do a lot of work all at the same time and pump stuff through.
Wow.
That does sound interesting. And that's live now, isn't it?
It is out there. It is ready for consumption. Wow. And it is being consumed.
Excellent. And will that come to the on-prem as well at some point in the next release?
We're hoping in the next release. There are some things we have to work out in terms of paths, source file paths and all that in the cloud we can kind of get away with, you know, hand-waving a little bit there because we don't have source files in the cloud. It's all binary. Mm-hmm. You give us a WAR, we scan it sort of thing. But with on-prem, you need to be able to map back to that source file very easily. And the technique we use on-prem is slightly different than the one we use for, you know, IDE plugins and such. So we should be able to get through that and put that in on-prem very, very soon. And I do know that the next on-prem release is going to have some of the features that we have in the cloud today. But we'll be able to talk about that when they get released.
Yeah, very good, very good. And Chris, you've been moonlighting since we last spoke, and you didn't tell us, you know, that you were going to appear on television. You know, so...
Yeah, I know. It's crazy. I didn't know either until about 2 days before it happened.
So Chris was on AppScan Tuesday, which we were on before.
Yes.
So he did a very good session on AppScan Source, which I enjoyed thoroughly. So
yes.
Thanks for that, Chris. And we've been on television as well, haven't we, Rob? We were on television last night. Yes.
We were. We had the great privilege of being part of the all-day DevOps conference and spoke on continuous security. So that was pretty fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Except for the fact that it was at 11:30 at night my time, but
yeah, sorry about that.
Those are details.
Yeah, I think when we submitted, they went, "Hey, Rob's on the West Coast, so let's stick it in the afternoon." And then I was like, "Well, Colin's in Ireland," but and the replay is certainly available. If you go to alldaydevops.com, you can get in and see it completely free. But it's a conference that starts at midnight on one night and ends on midnight on the next. And it's pretty awesome.
Insane. Yeah, no, it's insane. I mean, we had 30 minutes, we finished, and then there's someone else lined up. You know,
yep.
It's just exactly. Bang, bang, bang. You know, it's like lots of good content. Certainly worth checking out. And I think it's free just to go and
listen
to some of the bits and pieces on that.
Yeah, and the great thing is this is the first year that they had a track dedicated to DevSecOps. And so that was a really cool thing to be a part of.
Yeah, yeah.
The fact absolutely. That it exists at all is a hell of a move forward.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, yeah.
Let's move on, Chris, to your wonderful best practice for this week.
Yeah, we're gonna talk about regulations and common sense and how they're pretty much similar.
and you're just aware that Darius is going to be joining us later, aren't
yes.
you?
Yes.
That's the hope. We can speak to something that he's going to talk about in the abstract, and we'll try to frame it into something a little more concrete here. But really, common sense that isn't quite as common as you might think when it comes to regulations and security. And some of the penalties that you get for non-compliance now, especially around GDPR and stuff like that.
Exactly.
And really, I mean, there's a few easy things you can do or think about in your environment to really get you there. And what I'm going to start with is something that probably not a lot of people think, but that's encrypt everything at rest. You need to be a good steward of the data that you're using or being supplied to by your users. You shouldn't have anything open and in the clear anywhere if you can help it. It's a simple thing. All you got to do is make sure everything is encrypted. It's not hard. Make it happen. In fact, most cloud providers offer the ability to encrypt stuff that you're keeping at rest in their cloud environment. So even if somebody were to hack them, good luck, you know, within the life of the universe figuring out what this ABC/blah thing means to you. Hopefully it means nothing if you don't have the key.
Be a good steward of your data. I love that.
Be a good steward of your data. It's not just encrypting the data, but making sure you only keep the stuff that you need to keep. You can't just keep everything. I mean, there's no need to in some cases. You probably don't need to keep my credit card number if I'm never going back to you, for example.
Exactly.
You just need it for the one transaction, then get rid of it.
Yeah, so, well, and that's you know, I don't know if you guys heard, but earlier this week, right, November 8th, Hotels.com, Booking.com, and Expedia were all victim of a data breach exposing millions of sensitive guest records that were just out there. And so your point about encrypting everything at rest, right in line with that.
Yeah, it's not hard. Just do it. I mean, and not many people think about encrypting everything at rest. They're like, oh, I have it. It's in my data center. Nobody can get access to my data center except the people everywhere.
Yeah,
exactly. You know, just do the right thing. Encrypt everything at rest. And there are about 8 principles for software development or software securing systems. And my favorite principle is the principle of least privilege. And what that means is only give permissions to things for people that need them. One of my favorite things is 777 makes the world easy, right? If you're on Linux, it opens up every file system to everybody everywhere. It makes it easy. You don't have to worry about, you know, can I access this particular file? It's not a safe way to go about things, folks. Just don't do it. 777 does not make the world a better place. Stay away from that. And then one thing that I never really thought about before I got into security was using system to run your code in an environment. So you'll see a bunch of stuff that you install using the system account to run their stuff. And system is much higher elevation than a limited user. It's just able to get access to a lot of things that it shouldn't have access to. So think about that when you're installing in your environment. Do I use system to run, I don't know, my web server? Oh my God, that's bad. So be careful. Use and apply the principle of least privilege everywhere. I mean, the hoops we have to jump through just to get access to a scan in ASOC is astronomically crazy. And I don't even know if it's paranoid enough in some cases. Be paranoid. People will get access to your data at some point. Make sure you protect it. One of my favorite things that we still catch from time to time is hard-coded passwords in your environment or default passwords or things of that nature. Be careful when implementing any kind of defaults, especially when it comes to passwords. I mean, if you do a Google search right now for blah service default password and you get a hit, that's a sign that maybe you should probably change that password right away when you install said piece of software. Never keep the default passwords. Change them. It's not hard. Just do the effort. Bad actors can and do use these default passwords to get into systems they should not have access to. So once again, applying the principle of least privilege, keeping 777 on your default password is not a good idea.
Yep.
And one of my very, very favorites that for some reason really messes with people's minds is using char arrays or char arrays to store passwords as opposed to strings. In some languages, Java, strings are immutable. They don't go away when you're done using that object. They stay until they're garbage collected, which means your window of opportunity for them to scrape your memory and get that password is much longer and wider than if you use a char array, sign in, and then zero out that char array or replace it with a star character or put in gobbledygook. You need to protect and be a good steward of their data. If you get nothing else out of this, get that. Be a steward. They're trusting you with something intimately important to them. They should deserve that trust. You should deserve that trust every day.
I like that. A steward of your data.
One of my very favorites is assume a breach will happen. Don't assume you're above it. Don't assume that because you've closed the door and you've turned off the neon sign that says enter here because you've done such a great job with AppSec that you're immune to breaches. You're not. No matter how good you protect yourself or try to protect yourself, assume even so. I don't care if you spend $1 billion on application security. You will be breached. Someone's coming after you. Be ready for when that happens. Don't bury your head in the sand. Have a plan. Understand what you need to report, how you need to report it, as soon as you need to report it, so on and so forth. Like GDPR recommends or doesn't even recommend, they say you have 72 hours to tell the world or whoever you're supposed to tell. You have a breach. You need to get this word out there. I mean, if hotels.com and all those other things had the choice, do you really think they'd be pushing this out there to the world? Probably not. They'd probably be hiding it. So in many ways, these regulations are great for the consumer, for us, for the people that use these services. Not as good for the companies, admittedly, because, you know, you have to have that black mark out there. But you're going to get found out one way or the other. People will find out. You need to control how that message gets out there and what you're doing to protect their data and what they can do to remediate or mitigate the damage to themselves. And in some cases, it's change your passwords on every site you've ever been to, or don't use the same password that you use in everything. Get a password manager, stuff like that. So be ready for when that day happens, because it is coming and it's going to hit you at some point, or at least assume it will. I mean, not everybody's going to be hacked because not everybody's worth it. But one thing that I think that is interesting is planning for getting hacked or getting breached will almost certainly point out some weaknesses that you do have. Everybody has them. You need to understand what those weaknesses are, what your risk factors are in your environment, in your data security, in your access control lists. The list goes on. Be ready.
Yeah.
And certainly, last but not least, we'll go into regulations as a starting place to get ready. They're not the finish line. They're not the end game. They're not supposed to be all encompassing. They're they're literally the bare minimum bar that you have to make sure you conform to so that you can make sure your data is protected. And they're a good place to start. So if you have no idea what data security means, or if you have no idea how you're supposed to do these things, these regulations kind of outline in pretty extensive detail what that means. And it's really cool, in my opinion, that somebody's gone through the effort to build this list to say, yes, we're going to possibly punish you if you don't do it, but by the same token, here's what you need to do. Here's literally a checklist. Do this, and you are in a much better position to protect your environment and your consumers. Mm-hmm. I don't know why you would ever fight something like this.
But a lot of organizations have a lot of this documented, and it's part of their security standards and guidelines and things like that. I guess the real key here is being able to tie it all together and make sure that you're living that.
Yeah. So to speak, you know. So you need to peel back the covers. You need to see what's underneath. You need to figure out how to make, you know, everything right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, because if you don't, you're going to run into it at some point, right? You're going to be exposed. I mean, we've talked before about how long it takes to actually identify a breach in the first place. So chances are you may already have something lurking, you know, if you're not doing this and you haven't been a good steward of this stuff before. So certainly worth looking into.
Sound advice there, Chris. Sound advice. I like it.
Well, hey, everyone. We are super excited that our guest today is Darius Bennett. Darius is a certified master of data privacy, a thought provider, thorough researcher, keen legal analyst, legal consultant, contractor, and a licensed attorney. He's a recognized professional writer with 7 years of experience in high-level case assessment and analysis, and 14 years of experience in negotiations, settlements, and contract negotiations. He's got 3 years of experience in criminal defense as well. He's also bilingual and proficiently speaks, reads, writes, and professional level Spanish and English. And I had the pleasure of meeting Darius earlier during an online seminar by the SIA Institute, and found him to be thoroughly versed in this space. And so we're super excited to be able to get him on today to talk about data privacy and application security. So welcome, Darius. It's really nice to have you with us. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely, man. So, hey, we are really interested in the intersection of kind of AppSec and data privacy, and we've seen that data privacy has become a really, really big topic with a lot of different new rules and regulations. So I'm curious, what are some of the trends and things that you're seeing today around data privacy?
I would say that the primary trend is resistance. There is a lot of resistance, especially in the business sector, to being regulated in this way. And mostly because from their perspective, it's costing them money. So the trend that I'm seeing is resistance, and the scramble is not to improve their processes. Rather, what can we do to eliminate this barrier? In other words, get around it, create a situation such that it doesn't apply to us. So that's the trend that I'm seeing. Lots of resistance.
So resistance in terms of, hey, we don't want to have to adjust all our systems or pop these things up on websites, like that kind of thing?
Exactly.
Okay.
It almost seems as if many of them haven't really read CCPA enough to know that, you know, you can have just the pop-up, and in many ways that suffices. I first of all should say that I'm licensed in Georgia, so I can't give you any legal advice, or anyone listening, any legal advice with regard to CCPA, because it's a California specific statute. Okay. But what I can say is what appears to be happening is that people, I don't know if they've engaged counsel to read the statute thoroughly and give them advice about what they can and cannot do in terms of adjusting. It seems that their knee-jerk reaction has been resist. What can we do to postpone the enforcement of this statute? What can we do to put ourselves in an exception? What are the exceptions, and are we in it? Can we be in that area as opposed to adjusting? And I think if they read the statute, they'd see that the adjustment is not as difficult as they're making it.
It makes you wonder a little bit if they're spending more money avoiding doing the right thing as opposed to doing the right thing.
Yeah. Right.
Oh, but that does sort of lead into something that I'm curious about. As a developer myself, anything additional we're asked to do is, you know, it costs time, it costs effort. You know, instead of getting three features in, you might only get 2.5 or even 2 or 1 with all of the extra stuff we have to do. And we see some of the same situation when it comes to AppSec or application security that you see with all these regulations that are in place where there's just resistance and they just want to get the checkbox saying we did it, go away. But how do you feel that companies can maintain data privacy even as we're expecting them to do more things? What are some of the things you think that companies should really start to seriously consider?
Well, my first response and only response at this point would be data inventory. Start there. And it's I call it know your data, and I, you know, or data, however you choose to pronounce it. I don't know that I invented know your data. I might have heard it somewhere. But know your data, know what you have, know where you have it, know why you have it, know if third party vendors or third parties, however they exist in your world, you know, how much of that data do they have and where are they keeping it and who has access to it? So I would start with data inventory, and then you want to do data mapping. You want to determine who has access. Once you've mapped where all of the data is, you want to determine who has access to it. And then there's data retention and elimination. So mm-hmm. what should be kept, what should be eliminated? It's not as simple as going in and deleting, you know, what you believe to be unnecessary data. There may be statutes that apply to the data that you hold.
Right.
It's almost like a data threat model. Who are the bad actors and how can they get access? In this case, it's who are the good actors and what kind of access do they have?
Right. And I would imagine, Darius, there's probably a lot of discussion and, you know, maybe even some consternation, right, around who actually owns the data and is responsible for it. So are you seeing this kind of thing where organizations may be collecting it, but a different organization is storing it and somebody else is responsible for maintaining it? Are those kinds of things happening?
Well, if I'm being frank, what I've seen so far, honestly, it's just the resistance. And I think it's because all of this is still very new. I know that CCPA was drafted and passed in 2018, but enforcement began this year.
Right.
And you probably weren't watching this behavior, but they fought, and by they, I mean those who are the resistors, fought very hard to postpone it or carve out exceptions, et cetera.
Right.
So I don't think that they've gotten into, as they call it, the meat and potatoes of who has it, who has rights to it, et cetera.
So in terms of CCPA, from my understanding, it's based on the controls from the CIS, and one of them is entitled Application Software Security. And then you have the New York DFS, including language like robust application security programs. It sounds like it's similar. In your opinion, what is needed for organizations to be able to comply with these? So just to put it into context, you know.
Okay. So first I want to, for, you know, whatever part of your listening audience that may not understand all of the acronyms, by CIS, I assume you're referring to the Center for Internet Security.
Right.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. And NYDFS, New York DFS, is the New York State Department of Financial Services. Is that what you're referring to?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yep. Yes. Yeah. Okay. So I just want to make sure people listening know, there is often, and I think it's because, and you guys will appreciate this because you work in the technical, a conflation of data privacy and cybersecurity. They are interrelated, and those two people should be in the same room all the time. Rarely should they not be in the same room, in my opinion. But they are two different things. So the Center for Internet Security and the New York State Department of Financial Services, those are focuses on cybersecurity concerns, not necessarily data privacy. New York is working on a data privacy statute. And I believe that the last time I looked into it, I think it was called something like SHIELD. I'm an MCU nerd. So I was like, SHIELD? I wonder if they did that on purpose, but probably not. But.
Yeah, well, you're correct. It is called SHIELD. And my first thought was it is related to Marvel, right?
Yeah.
that whole thing. So yeah. But yeah, I actually think that went into effect in March of this year, if I remember right.
I'd have to look at that again. I don't know that they were able to get that pass. I'll take your word for it. I won't, you know.
Okay.
But going back to Colin's question, I believe in terms of the application software security, you're referring to Control 18?
Yes.
CIS Control 18. Okay, that again is related to cybersecurity. But to address the intersectionality, as millennials call it, between cybersecurity and data privacy. I think that what developers would do, like what you do on your end, you'd be cautious about how much consumer data you're involving in your processes. And when you are writing the programs, what information does it pull in and why? And is it necessary to pull in that information?
Right.
So it's more than just what am I collecting and why am I collecting it? I would expect it's probably more along the lines of what am I collecting? Why am I collecting it? How am I storing it? And who has access?
There you go.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Seems like a pretty simple thing to solve. I don't know why there's resistance and it's not going away. It's only going to get worse as time goes on. That's and the world exactly becomes right. More and more, you know, with 5G, it's going to change the way we look at everything. Everything's going to be through your phone pretty soon.
Sure. But a lot of people think of 5G as not a hoax. They don't take it seriously because the term 5G has been co-opted and turned into, you know, this whole
conspiracy theory.
People on Twitter, and they've built up conspiracy theories around 5G and its capabilities. And I look at it and I think it's so absurd that I researched it to make sure that I wasn't being arrogant. You know, I was like, that's so absurd. I've got to look into this. It was that level of absurd. I'm like,
yeah, of course it's COVID.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And that's why I was like, I understand science enough to know that it couldn't cause COVID, but maybe there's something I'm missing.
Yeah.
Pretty in there. I thought, just in case, let me just look.
It's related somewhere, right?
Before I say it's not related,
I think one way or the other, though, whether or not 5G is quote unquote causing problems or not, or whatever the conspiracy theory is, one truth is happening, and that's we're getting faster. We're just getting faster access to data at just crazy exponential levels. So one way or the other, data privacy is no longer, you know, make sure you have your sheet of paper in a locked cabinet. It's how are you storing this crap on your cloud? Because cloud is a lot of things, very secure in many cases, but also accessible to the world in many cases. So there's going to be nothing but more that you're going to have to do. And you might as well get used to it now, it seems to me.
Yeah.
Accessible to the world if you don't have, and here is the intersection again, if you don't have the right data security.
If you don't have the right data security.
Yeah. Right.
That's where data security, that's why the privacy people and the security people should always be in the same room. That's the vulnerability. I should, if I'm the privacy person, I should tell you, here's what's on the cloud and it needs to be protected because here are the financial consequences, not to mention like the fallout publicly to, you know, this, the exposure of this data. What can you do to secure it? And I will tell you who should have access to it. The reason that it seems like a cheap solution is because we believe in it. But people who are decision makers, they know where they want to spend their money. Yeah. So if I'm your data privacy person slash, you know, in-house counsel or however you want to label me, and you, Chris, for instance, are the, you know, security person, perhaps the decision makers don't want us sitting in a room discussing these sorts of things when they'd rather we be working on something else because they think it's, you know, more profitable.
Mm. Right.
So we have a problem from the top also, it sounds like. And it's weird how the analogs are with application security, data privacy. Yeah. It's just the same problem. Nobody sees it as what it is.
Right.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
At the end of the day, right, it gets down to the same risk discussion because it's not really reasonable for an organization or, you know, every organization to think that we're going to remember all of the places we interacted and all of the places we entered data and then, you know, go back and pick and choose which ones that we're going to say, hey, get rid of my stuff or, you know, that kind of thing, right? So putting it on an individual can actually sometimes be a real challenge. And historically, right, if you think about why we get all these targeted ads and things, you know, every time we go into a store, it's because the model was, well, let's collect everything because we might want to use it someday, right? So we always collect more than we need. And it seems like that pendulum has now swung entirely the other direction to where we really have to take a minimalist approach, right? Take only the data we need to do something with.
Like principle of least privilege, principle of least information.
Well, I'll tell you a funny story about this, right? You guys may have heard this before, but when my daughter was signing a lease in Arizona, now Arizona's had a law on the books as well since 2018 around data privacy. It went through the assembly bill, and I think it was 1514, if I remember right, something like that. But so I may have the numbers wrong, but the idea was, you know, personal data should be secured. And they had done the right information on a piece of paper stored in a file cabinet thing, but the guy had scanned it. And so when my daughter was going for this, you know, this place there, and I said, hey, send me a copy of the lease because, you know, as your dad, I want to take a look, make sure you're all right and all that kind of stuff. I was shocked when the lease had some key information on the current tenants who were in that place. And I was like, there's no way that should have that.
No.
And so I confronted the landlord and I was like, hey, you can't do that. You can't be sharing that. And his response was like, well, basically, well, no one's told me that I couldn't. And like,
yeah,
state legislature kind of did, but you're not aware of it. Right. So it's, yeah, it's that kind of stuff.
Ignorance is no defense in this.
Yeah.
No, in criminal or civil context. And I can, you know, generally say that it's mistake of, there is a difference between mistake of fact and mistake of law. So mistake of law, there's, is indefensible, but mistake of fact is.
Well, and the point for me was just that this guy had no idea, right? So assuming that the citizenry in general is going to know how to handle their data properly and be able to go back and do that with every organization they interact with doesn't really seem to make a lot of sense.
Even the interpretation can be different. So I live in Ireland, the Darius, and just so you know, but I it was last year, I went and got a blood test, you know, just a regular checkup at my doctor. And I asked if he would send me the results. And he said, no, he couldn't because of GDPR. He could tell me the results, but he couldn't send them to me. And I was just thinking, well, and his opinion is that data belongs to him, not to me, even though it's about me, you know?
So no, that's actually contrary to GDPR. GDPR is an independent data that belongs to you.
Yeah, I know. that's the point. It's the interpretation that gets all screwed up. You know, this is a local doctor, you know, he just
doesn't want to get burned.
I want to emphasize, so this is not an attack on you. It's not the interpretation he got wrong. He has misunderstood GDPR.
Sure.
He does not understand it. So if you were so inclined, you could go back and insist.
Oh, and that's what I did do. I got it. But I think the point is that people just get frightened off, this is coming, I need to make sure I'm compliant and do the right thing. And they're not necessarily doing the right thing. You know,
that's right. And I think I can tie in like a lot of the comments that Chris and Rob and you have now made. And it's that this starts with education.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first people who have to get on board are people in government. They have to get on board. And then you start public campaigns where people are being educated about, well, particularly you want to educate businesses and people who deal with the data, because the consumer is already educated. The consumer is probably very active on the internet or interactive with people who are active on the internet, and they know their rights. They were the impetus behind, you know, the GDPR and CCPA and Illinois' biometric statute, etc. And Maine has a statute now, Nevada has a statute now. The consumer drove those statutes. So the consumer is aware. It's business that needs to buy in and educate themselves. And a point that I'm always making on LinkedIn is my primary concern for the United States is that Europe is moving forward no matter what. GDPR is very strong. It is enforced. And in the legal sector, it is respected. So if the U.S. wants to continue doing business in Europe and with Europe, we'll have to get on board. This is not a situation where we can muscle them into doing what we want. And not trying to be polemical, but, you know, in the not so distant past, that was something that we were able to do with business practices, kind of muscle our way into getting what we wanted. And it's not going to work that way anymore. And, you know, I credit Max Shrims.
Yeah. But is it not a case in the US that you're kind of doing it state by state as opposed to at a federal level?
Because there's no federal buy-in.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And I think what I, and I will admit that I'm generalizing. My general understanding of Europeans is that you don't appear to understand how American politics work. Everything in terms of buy-in is top-down. So if they buy in at the top, everyone underneath, or I shouldn't say everyone, because some of us buy in either way, all of the others underneath who have not bought in will begin to buy in. But if at the top you haven't bought in, no one else will buy in. And so that's why the states have to, you know, do their separate statutes. So there's no buy-in at the top because of, you know, who our current president is. I'm bold enough to say that much. And so I think a great analogy would be our COVID response. We have no real federal level COVID response. So states have had to, on an individual basis, create their own responses. The problem with that is that California, Washington, Oregon have been very scientific and protective of their citizenry. But there are other states who have taken, could be generous, a more relaxed approach. But you can't stop people from those states, say Florida, from traveling to California. So even if California behaves itself, you can't stop a Floridian from visiting California and spreading coronavirus. Or Orange County, as I understand, in California is a hotspot. So you can't stop someone from Orange County from driving up to San Francisco or flying up to San Francisco and visiting San Francisco. The same is true with, you know, these data privacy regulations. There's no top down. So the only thing that certain states can do is we will protect our citizenry. So California has done it, Nevada has done it, Maine has done it. Illinois is working on another statute, but they already have one. It's the biometric, I want to get this right, Biometric Information Privacy Act. And as we know, biometrics are, you know, facial recognition, thumbprints, any of your physical characteristics that would be associated with who you are, with your identity. So they are working on an expansion of that, but that's already passed. But, you know, of course, biometrics, that's narrow. It doesn't include the categories. I mean, I haven't read it thoroughly of information that would be included in CCPA, not all of them, at least.
Right. And I think that leads into something that I wanted to ask you about, Darius, because that idea of clear information. And speaking as someone who lives in Orange County, California, I can assure you it's not a hot spot.
Okay, good.
I see it every day. So we've actually been pretty excited about that. But that is not to say that California isn't a very divided state in terms of how we approach a lot of those things. But one of the things I've really appreciated about you personally, and I will say, you know, we introduced and said you're a very accomplished writer, and I don't take that lightly. I've read a lot of the articles that you've put out for EDRM, and if those listening, if you haven't had a chance, follow Darius on LinkedIn and check out some of his articles. He's incredibly thoughtful and candid, and I think he has really good takes on some of the things. But there was an article you wrote that was entitled Clear Intention and the Irrepressible Power of Unity. And I really thought that was pretty powerful. And talking about the importance of speaking plainly and having clear language. And you used a great story of when you were playing doubles as part of the Atlanta Tennis Association or the Tennis League there. So I'm curious, when it comes to this whole area of data privacy and this intersection, people get lost in the legalese pretty quickly. So what do you think we can do to help folks understand this plainly and clearly and make it a lot easier for organizations to participate and comply and for us as citizens to be able to protect our data better?
First, I just want to thank you for saying those nice things. I'm flattered. I don't know what else to say. Thank you for even reading those articles.
Oh, they're awesome.
Wow, thanks. Second, you have to get the right people in the room, and you have to have at least two people in the room who are willing to say what needs to happen, even if their knees are shaking. And that's how you'll get the clear language. And I say two people because one person may be having a very strong day, but the very next day at the follow-up meeting or the very next week at the follow-up meeting, they may not feel brave enough to stick their chest out again.
Right.
So you have that other person in the room who's willing to stick her chest out as well. And now you have two people in the room who intend to do the right thing. And so I would say it starts there. You need at least two people in the room who intend to do the right thing, even if their knees are shaking under the table. And I don't say that lightly, because having worked at multiple law firms, it's not always easy to talk to your boss about what you believe is the right thing to do, especially if it's, I don't want to use the right thing, because that I don't want to malign any of my boss's professional characters. I might think this is more appropriate, and my boss may disagree with that and say that I think you are overthinking it, and I don't think that we need to do as much as that. And, you know, I need you to focus on this instead. Mm. If I have to, every time on my own, even though there are other attorneys in the room, have that conversation with him, essentially by myself, because there I am, you know, putting my head essentially perhaps on the perhaps on the chopping block by saying, no, I disagree, or I think this should happen, or I think that should happen, or I think, you know, we need more of this, and no one else says anything. You know, you feel like an island unto yourself. If there are two people in the room willing to do that, that changes. You know, when they see that you're buckling, you know, they'll step in front of you, you know, and say, I agree with Darius, or I agree with Rob. And here's why, from my perspective, I also think that's true. So I think, you know, that's how you get the clear intentions, clear language in the room. You need the right people.
So just to change a little bit, you know, some of the other sort of standards that are out there. I'm quite familiar with HIPAA. You know, I would have done a lot of work from that, from, you know, evaluating applications. Do you think there are similar kinds of data privacy laws for other industries that will emerge?
I think it's inevitable. I think, again, there will be lots of resistance, because American business people, I can only speak from my experience with American business people. I have limited experience with European business people and South America. But American business people put money first, for the most part. Certainly a generation of American, three generations of American business people put money first.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's just interesting that certain industries really focus in on this and do this well, whereas, you know, areas like retail, you know, there are other areas where it doesn't seem to be as strong, you know. So maybe
let's juxtapose the two ideas, retail and HIPAA. HIPAA specifically regards health information.
Yes. Yeah.
And that makes a person very vulnerable. So it was an easier buy-in eventually, because HIPAA hasn't always existed. There had to be some exposures, you know, before it came into existence. But once it came into existence, it made sense. So there has to be a buy-in there. Sadly, here in the States, there will have to be punishments first.
Yes. Yeah.
Right.
There will have to be suffering first. I hate saying it that way. I was born and raised in the United States. I'm 44 years old. I would like for it to be different at this point in my life.
The old businesses just do the right thing and not have to have HIPAA or anything like
that. Right, that's right.
So why does HIPAA even need to exist? It's always blown my mind.
Yeah, or have HIPAA, fine, have HIPAA, but why so much resistance? Why does a triggering event have to happen for something that makes so much sense? I mean, HIPAA protects personal medical information. That, for me, is commonsensical.
You shouldn't need HIPAA to tell you to do that.
Well, right. That's right. Right. But common sense is not so common.
Right. Well, and it's the same thing too, right? A lot of times, when do people take cybersecurity seriously? It's after a breach.
That's right.
So yeah. it's unfortunately the same sort of thing that sometimes you don't make that short-term sacrifice for long-term gain.
Right.
Yeah, and you never see the breaches that you've prevented by doing application security. So you're like, I think I saved the company $500 million this year, but I don't know.
Yeah. And certainly I think companies are insulated from their mistakes by tech people who go in and clean up the mess. And so, you know, when you get back into those decision-making meetings, they can say, okay, well, you know, this happened, but we cleaned it up, we contained it, there's no need to this, you know, overreact or over respond to it. You know, we've contained the problem, we've eliminated the problem. So, and no policies change, really, it seems. And you can correct me if I'm wrong, because you're on the inside, but no policies change. Just good job. Thanks for catching that.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's, and I like to say too, for IT professionals or folks in this space, right? You normally are only noticed when things go wrong. So no one's coming around and in your office this morning going, hey, yes, the internet is still working and I can still connect, right? But that's what they're doing, right? Keeping the lights on and all of those kinds of things. So yeah, it's that space. Well, awesome. Darius, we've so enjoyed talking to you. So anyway, but I do have one question for you though, just before we go, because I know you are a huge tennis fan and you and I have talked about this before. So if you had that opportunity, right, to play doubles with one of the Williams sisters, who you picking, Venus or Serena?
This is, this is such a great question, because I go on, I'll try to make this answer brief. I know that I have long answers.
It's totally fine.
For health reasons, like I go on long walks, 4-mile walks, and they clear my head and they're good for my physical health as well. And on my last walk, which was Sunday, I was walking along and sometimes it relaxes me to, you know, fantasize about playing doubles with, like, you know, some favorite double player, tennis player, professional tennis player. And that person on Sunday was Venus Williams.
Ah.
And I kept thinking about, I even thought about, like, how I would, you know, be super focused and not miss a ball and run for everything. And, you know, God forbid she even, you know, she would never even need me, you know.
Yeah, if a ball even came at you. I was there for the two hits I needed to be there for.
To be clear, you're playing alongside her or against
her?
Yes,
no, alongside her.
Okay. Against her. He's not insane.
I would never oppose Queen Venus. Can I just say this about her? You started this, Rob. So I just want to say something. I'm a huge Venus Williams fan, so I shouldn't put that caveat out there. But she's underestimated as an athlete.
I totally agree with you on that one.
People see her sister and her. Serena's a phenomenal athlete. She's a phenomenal tennis player. Her mind is very strong. Serena's mind. Venus, a lot of people don't know unless you're a super fan like myself, is a two-sport athlete. She was a track star until she was about 14. Wow. She is, I think she was something like 16-0 or something, some absurd number. And track meets before she dedicated her athleticism to tennis.
Wow.
So she is a two-sport athlete. And if you ever saw her before Shogren's, gliding and bounding about the court and lifting herself into the air, you know, almost like arabesque to get, like, you know, high backhand volleys and to slam down, like, winners that swing volleys. It's it was artistry. Mm-hmm. And I think and Serena has earned it. But I think that, you know, with Serena being in the front now, people have forgotten that.
Right. And
I wish that people would remember that. That has nothing to do with data privacy, but
but it's important.
And there's a lot of that people don't know about Venus though too, and in, you know, injuries and some things robbing some years off of her career. But yeah. It's fascinating. Darius and I spent a lot of time at the SIA event talking about Venus Williams. So it was pretty fun.
Yeah.
Had nothing to do with cyber, but it was great. Darius, man, I thank you so much for taking time out today to talk to us, help us understand this data privacy space. I know it's a huge area that's just going to continue to grow in importance. And so who knows, we may want to talk to you further at some point about this. But thanks so much for your time and joining us. And we just look forward to seeing where this goes.
Awesome.
Yeah, appreciate it. Yeah, thanks a million, Darius.
Thank you. Thank you for including me. And I'd be happy to be back. Thanks again.
You bet, man.
All right. Thanks. Be safe. Be easy out there.
You too.
Okay.
All right.
So that brings us to the end of another fine podcast. We are going to do, we'll have two more shows before the end of the year and before we end this season. So I think for our final show, we might do an awards
season or some sort of Christmas special or something like that. So, mm-hmm. so hold tight for that, and we'll do something a bit different for our last episode. So.
Yes, and let's remind our listening audience that we now actually have a Twitter handle, so you can follow us at @ApparanoiA on Twitter, and we would love to engage with you guys there.
Absolutely, yeah. So ApparanoiA is going to have its own pace in the world soon, you know. So,
yes,
which is good. So anyway, thanks, chaps. Thanks, Rob. Thanks, Chris. It's been fun as always.
Oh yeah. Till next time. Oh, I can't wait for the Christmas special. I'm going to give myself a present.